Computer. Okay, go ahead.
You got it all set up? Cool. Okay. Well, welcome everyone. This is, of course, our first Sunday in the fall session. And yeah, jazz hands. Okay, cool. And of course, you might have noticed that we're doing this remote. You might not notice that, but we're not exactly sure when we're going to go live again. A lot of it has to, you know, do with the pandemic and where things are. And as you know, a lot of our members, including myself, are in that bracket of people who need to be more careful. So until the government, you know, has figured out what we should be doing and letting us know, I think we'll be on remote. But that's okay. I'm actually really impressed with the technology. You know, it's not the same thing as being face to face, but you know, it's really quite good. So it's all good. So I wanted to remind people that please keep rolling mantras. I know you're probably tired of rolling mantras. I'm tired of rolling mantras, but I just did a bunch yesterday, and I'm going to do more, you know, because the statue is a big size statue. It's going to take a lot of mantras. So please keep doing that. My plan now is if, you know, the pandemic situation permits, then probably in December we'll consecrate the statue. That's, you know, that we'll have to see. There. Oh, okay. So now I'm central. My buddy here, Mr. Buddha. So we're doing something a little bit different. We thought we'd give a try, see how it works, this session. And so what we're doing is we're picking important topics, and then each week a different person's going to speak on that topic. And you know, bring some different perspective to it, right? So I'm going to speak this week, and Ken? Are you speaking next week, Ken? Oh, Steph, you're speaking next week. Okay, sorry, I don't have the schedule in front of me. Anyhow, so it's going to rotate through the teachers, and everyone's going to bring a different perspective, and then you know, after we've gotten several perspectives, we're going to move on to another topic, right? And we thought this might be a good way is kind of, you know, flesh out the topic from a lot of different perspectives, and how you can understand it and how you can practice with it. And we'll see how it goes. See what people think after we've tried it for a couple of months. So that's kind of where we're at. If you're interested, this is the usually in English we call him Vairochana Buddha. He's the I'll give you a little background here. He's the largest bronze Buddha in the world. For centuries, he was the largest Buddha in the world. This temple is located in Nara, Japan, it was an engineering marvel in two different ways. The first was making a statue, because no one had ever made a bronze statue. It was about the 8th century. No one had ever made a bronze statue this big, and so they really, you know, had to figure out how they were going to do this. How are they going to make this giant bronze statue and get it to work, right? And then the second thing is that, as some of you might know, bronze is a pretty heavy metal. And so they had to puzzle over how to move the statue into the temple. Right? Because, you know, being so big, it presented all sorts of problems. And then, of course, because bronze is real heavy, right? So they're actually quite ingenious. It took a long time to do this, but what they did was they made the casting mold on site. So they just built this giant casting mold, and then of course scaffolding, framework, and stuff like that. And they melted the metal and poured it in. And then when it cooled, they removed the mold, right? So then they had a giant Buddha sitting in the middle of a field, and they built the temple around it, right? So, right. So that's how they managed it. And it's really something to see. So if you ever get to Nara, you can go there. The last time I was, I have this friend. He's also in the Dharma. He lives down in America. And he's one of these like magical guys, you know, like something always completely out, you know, crazy stuff out of the blue happened. That's always good when he's around. I don't know how that is, but anyhow, that's kind of like, you know, his karma, right? So when I was living in Japan last time, a few years ago, he had never been to Japan. And I said, well, you know, come on, I got an apartment over here. You can crash, you know, and I got an extra room. You can stay there. So he came. We went to Nara. And unknowing to either of us, they were having some giant festival. And they had just hundreds and hundreds of people in traditional costumes, right? And they're all, you know, playing music and dancing. And they got to in front of this temple and they did this big dance thing, right, with drums and all sorts of stuff. It was just fabulous, right? The whole day. So we were quite lucky. And even though I've been to Nara, like, you know, maybe 8-10 times, I never seen anything like it. It was just a very large festival. So wonderful. It's a great temple to visit if you get a chance. Bhairochana, by the way, the name means, well, you can translate it different ways, but basically it means the illuminator. In Japanese character, they literally translated it as Big Sun, Big Sun Buddha. And he's the main Buddha spoken about in the Avatamsaka Sutra, right? Or in Japanese, it's called Keigan, the Keigan Kyo. So it's a very big sutra, really big. It's like maybe equal to about 4 Bibles long. So, very interesting. Anyhow, so there we are. And that has nothing to do with my talk. I'm just, you know, giving you the kind of the background here. All right, so my talk, right? So today we begin our investigation of the idea of illusion. Then over the next few weeks, we're going to explore this concept from different perspectives. For today's discussion, I wish to make a distinction between delusion and illusion. The first term I am referring to something that is falsely believed. For example, a curled up piece of rope mixed among the vegetation along a mountain path at first glimpse is believed to be a snake. So that's a delusion. An illusion is something that is misapprehended as objectively existing. So for example, you're driving on a hot day and you see a pool of water on the road in front of you. But when you get to that spot, there's no water, right? So it looked like there was something existing there, but there was nothing there. Right. And that's different from when you see something that's there, but you didn't understand what it really was. So you kind of confused it, right? All right. So that's how I'm going to talk about things. Of course, in actual fact, the words delusion and illusion often get mixed up. So this is just for today's talk. The great work by Vasubandhu, which is entitled the Abhidhamma Kosha, informs us that, quote, all lust, anger, and delusion belong to the sphere of desire, with the exception of the belief in a self. Okay, so from this, we know there's a difference between delusion about things and the misapprehension about self. So I will focus on the second item. However, as I said, these terms often get, used interchangeably. So if you listen to another conversation, then you have to understand the terms as they're using. So Buddhism is well known as a teaching of no self. Yet such an idea goes against our experience. Each of us rather innately feel that there is a self. The self undergoes changes, but there seems to be some sort of single thing, like a thread, running through all of these changes. So how does this come about? To begin with, we have an apprehension of there being an experiencer when we process information from our senses. That is, according to Buddhism, our senses, touch, taste, sight, hearing, smell, and thought, are activated by a stimulus in their appropriate field. And we not only have the experience of, say, hearing a sound, but also the consciousness of having that experience. That is, you hear a car horn, but you also have the thought, I'm hearing a car horn. Secondly, we have memory. In your mind, the child playing on the beach is a recorded fact in the memory of the old woman sitting in a rocking chair. The old woman has many facts stored in her memory, just like a computer has many documents stored in its memory. You, however, do not have a memory of your last life or what happened between your last life and this life. In fact, we people can't actually imagine being dead. In terms of our memory and in terms of each experience, you always were. And because of this, it is natural to think that you would continue on. So, although your body may die, the real you, the soul, will continue on, right? Christians believe that the real you will go to heaven if you've been good and accepted Jesus, or go to hell if you've been bad. Hindus believe the real you will be reincarnated. And this idea of a real you is so strong, you will create a you to experience your dreams. In your dreams, the dreamer creates a self who goes through the dream because we don't know how to experience without an experiencer. In the Tibetan Book of the Dead, it teaches we create a similar self to go between our lives. This is called the bardo body, and it's just like a dream body. But all of this is wrong. First, if you gain some mastery over particular meditations, entering into their samadhis, you can experience an awareness or a clarity that is free of the experience of self. Of course, at the time, You cannot think, I'm not experiencing a self. But when you have left that samadhi, you will know that you did have an experience of no self. From the experience of no self, we can know that the experiencer is actually connected with the experience, and the two arise together. Second, your memories are not a simple recording of facts. There are a number of psychological studies that demonstrate that both in the making of a memory and in the recalling of a memory, there is a process of selection and distortion. If you are studying a vocabulary list as you progress to learning a second language, and you are sitting on your deck, you are focused on the new words you must learn. You have selected out any sound that may come your way, and that a fly has landed on the table that holds your book. In the future, you will recall the words, but not the fly. We all know that if a group of people experience a bank robbery, the police will get a different description from each of the witnesses, because what people recall of the robber is their perceptions along with their emotional overlay. So one person saw a cold face, another a rough face, and another a brutish face. Perhaps everyone would have just seen an average face if the robber was simply another customer. What we remember is our experience of the event, which is colored by our mindset. From these investigations, we can determine that our memory is incapable of providing a support for the notion that there is a self, and that consciousness is equally incapable of providing that support, since it is situational and can be transcended. And thus, the self is an illusion, just like the pool of water on the hot road. You can clearly see it. It is always in front of you, but you can never get to it. However, even though it is an illusion, we strongly hold to it. So try sometime when you're driving to not see the pool of water. It's impossible. It's always there. So for this discussion, we can conveniently divide our experience of the world as experiencer and things experienced. Things experienced may be from external stimuli or may be internal, like a thought. We can go through life wishing and acting in such a way as to try to increase the experiences that bring us pleasure and decrease the experiences that bring us displeasure. Pleasure and pain themselves are interpretations of stimuli, although we think of them as actual experiences. You don't experience pleasure or pain. You experience a stimulus, and the experiencer interprets it as pleasure or pain. So that is part of the illusion. The Perfection of Wisdom in 8,000 Lines states, quote, although we speak of a self, yet absolutely the self is something uncreated. Here is a little practice for you then. Every time you feel slightly annoyed or discomforted, look inside yourself as to why this feeling comes up. Look at your own thinking, your categories, your values, and etc. that are part of you which lead to this feeling in the present moment. For now, disregard the external and focus on your internal. You will learn a lot about the self in this way. Because the experiencer arises along with the experience, This tells us something about the nature of things. In Indian Buddhism, they do not speak of the One, as this term was earlier used by Hindu yogis, meaning Brahman. We do find the term used outside of India much more. The oneness in Indian Buddhism is usually termed the non-dual. The Vimalakirti Nirdesha Sutra has a chapter called The Dharmador of Non-Duality. In this chapter, many bodhisattvas offer their understanding of the non-dual. For example, very good bodhisattva states, quote, self and selflessness are dualism, since the existence of self cannot be perceived. What is there to be made selfless? Thus, the non-dualism of the vision and their nature is the entrance into non-duality, end quote. After each bodhisattva gives an answer, which all basically goes as X, not X, are dualism, so they don't exist, Manjushri states that all of the other teachings mentioned are dualities, and not engaging in those X's is non-duality. Vimalakirti, when asked to give his answer, makes no reply. Thus, not engaging in dualism at all. If you haven't read this sutra, please do. It's a wonderful sutra. I point this out to because all there is the non-dual. The notion that there is a nirvana and samsara, a self and another, pain and pleasure, or any other dualism is the illusion. These are all false dichotomies. During the day, we go about engaging in unneeded dichotomies as a way of diverting our mind. The ego, the self, wants to continue to exist. To do that, it constantly generates all sorts of dichotomies. This is why you get stuck in like mindless mental loops, right? You know, like you get some jingle repeating in your head, you can't get it out of your head, or, you know, some rock and roll song from 1962 or whatever it was, you know, and it just keeps replaying because the self arises with the experience, with the object. And so if there's no object, the self, you know, boop. That's what the bodhisattva was saying. What's to make selfless, right? Okay. So during the day, you're going about making all these unneeded dichotomies, right? Sometimes we need to make dichotomies, but a lot of times it's just, you know, just a endless loop going on. In your formal meditation practice, dwelling in the emptiness of emptiness, then, during the day, enter into the activities only to the extent needed and return to that emptiness of emptiness, even if only for a few moments. By doing this, you'll rest more and more naturally in that non-dual. Right? So please be free. Thank you. And do you have any questions?
I think one of the phrases that stood out to me, because one of the areas that I'm interested in and may become part of my later talk, is this non-dual duality between sort of ultimate expression and understanding, and between our subjective expression and understanding. And the phrase that you used that I think is interesting for me to investigate is that, correct me if I'm wrong, is that our self, our perspective of self, arises with an object. Was that the correct phrase, first of all? Yeah. So we exist in a reality, if you will, that is that non-dualistic reality, but that's not how we perceive things. And it's interesting that the object that arises is also non-dual.
Yes.
Two non-duals create a kind of dual.
Yeah, so that's like in the Heart Sutra where it says, emptiness is form and form is emptiness. Mm-hmm. Right? It's kind of the same concept here, right? It's all non-dual, and the two non-duals, create a dual. These things are difficult to talk about because, to say it exists in this way, right? I mean, that's basically a lie because you can't say it exists, right? Exists, not exists, those are part of the false dichotomies. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, sorry, someone else was going to say something?
Yeah, I think you touched on meditation. Everything goes beautifully. You feel what you feel. I don't know. It goes well, and then you go into your daily life, and it's hard to bring that into your daily life. And you mentioned enter into activities only as needed. Could you repeat that last bit of your talk?
So enter into activities only to the extent needed, right? So I mean, if you're driving a car and you get a red light, you have to enter into red light, green light type of thing, at least hopefully, so that's what you have to do, right? But then there's all the other junk that goes on in our head. Okay, so we've stopped at the red light and we're sitting there, and then we got all these other things going on, right? We might have the radio on and, we're mentally, playing around with that. We're watching the people walk across the walkway, and we're looking at the other car, and we're making all of these distinctions, and we're doing all of this stuff, none of which is necessary at all. Enter into the extent that's needed and then let the rest go.
Good advice. Inundated with waves,
We are, and our world is gotten even more, right? All this wonderful technology that we have absolutely floods the field with constant demands on our dichotomizing stuff, right? So you get a cell phone and all, you get a beep bloop, and then your bleep bloop, you think, oh, what's that? And you look at it and you go, oh, okay, well, Jim sent me a note. I better see what Jim has. Jim wants to know. Look at the weather, Jim. Oh my goodness, we have a thunderstorm coming. And it's like, right? I mean, all this stuff is like just completely bombarding us. Now, sometimes it's important to know what Jim wants, or sometimes it's important to know that a thunderstorm is on the way, or whatever. That's fine. But the rest of it is just like, it's just like the wind pushing more and more waves, and you're caught up on the waves instead of returning back to the peaceful bottom of the pool there.
Would you say that maybe we should be observers more? I think especially with all that's going on, I know that there can be this sense of guilt at not, like there's fires and protests and COVID and a sense of guilt for not like deeply engaging in what's happening so far away from you, and that I don't know, is it wrong to adopt an attitude of I can do, I can only help what I can change around me, and what I can't change around me, maybe I shouldn't worry about. Is that maybe not a good attitude? Or
well, this is kind of the attitude that I've always taken, right? I try to affect what I can affect, right? There's all sorts of great events in the world. Some of them are wonderful. Some of them are absolutely terrible, but I have absolutely no control over any of it, right? Now, I might donate money. You know, I mean, if there's been a big disaster somewhere in the world, I might donate some money to the Red Cross or something like that, you know, to try to help relieve the suffering of the people there. But basically, I try to focus my attention on what I can do here, right? What I can do now. Right? So, and then because those things are always going on, right? Our world has always been a world where there's a million things going on. And the only difference is nowadays we have the ability to be aware of everything. And if you think, say, 1960s, you know, you just wouldn't know that over in Thailand something happened, you know, or over in Poland something. We just wouldn't know these things because, you know, this ability to quickly move information around the world just didn't exist. Please go ahead.
Oh, I saw somebody interviewing the Dalai Lama lately, and they asked him about, you know, politics and Trump, and you visited other American leaders, and you haven't visited Trump. And he said, oh, I forget how he answered, but then the interviewer said, what do you think about his politics? And the Dalai Lama says, that's none of my business, kind of, that's your business, right? So,
yeah, that's right. So, I mean, it's just, you know, just do what you can, you know, you can do. And then the rest of it, just let it go, because it's just another distraction. Right? It's just another thing to keep you tied up to samsara.
Is it kind of an illusion? It's there, you can see it, but you can't ever get to it. Like, especially with the net now, the internet. But.
Yeah, well, there's both illusion and delusion in there. Another question.
Maybe a quick one, Sherfu. You mentioned about the Tibetan Book of the Dead and the bardos, and then I think you made the comment that it's actually incorrect. Did I misinterpret that, or?
I wasn't saying that the Tibetan Book of the Dead was incorrect. I was saying that, you know, the naive view about the self is incorrect. Right. I highly recommend reading the Tibetan Book of the Dead. There was a translation made by Gyurme Dorje, who he just recently passed away, but he was a very good translator of Tibetan texts. And it's reasonably accurate translation. It goes in depth, which most of the other available books that go by that title usually don't. If you're interested, read it. It really has a lot of useful information on Buddhism and about kind of the processes that are involved. And it's not just about dying. There's you know, really a whole lot more there. I actually studied this with the Lama for 3 years, you know, very traditional, you know, sitting at the feet of the Lama, and we went through the entire thing. I do highly recommend it. Not so easy to practice everything that's in there, but at least you kind of understand, you know, it's talking about all these sort of psychological forces and what goes on inside of us. So, Gyurme Dorje, he was actually a Scot not a Tibetan, but he went by his Tibetan name.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
I also wanted to ask about rolling mantras. Do you have like a printout for the, I could roll mantras at home too.
Oh, okay. You didn't get the printout?
No. No, okay. Yeah.
We must have Elaine's email address, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So yeah. Then I will make sure you get a copy of the mantras, and then you got to cut it out. And then the instructions are quite easy. You get the sheet and then you cut it out, and then you just glue a small little piece of incense on the right-hand side, and then you need a small piece of ribbon on the left-hand side, and then you start with the incense side and you roll that up, and then the ribbon wraps around it, and then you tie it off with a string.
Neat. I don't know if that's obvious in words. I'll try to do pictures.
Okay, thanks, Steph. And then what's going to happen is that all these mantras are going to be, you know, put inside the new Buddha statue, right? And so it blesses the Buddha statue and makes it powerful. And then when people come and they make offerings or they bow and whatnot, you know, those mantras will give them a lot of blessings.
Perfect. Is there any color of ribbon that can't be used or shouldn't be used? I'm thinking of lots of
ribbon. Mostly we've been using red and yellow.
Red and yellow, so. Okay. Cool.
So that'd be great. Thank you for volunteering. And Steph, thank you for pictures. That's why you need a new house, right? Your house is completely filled up with rolled up mantras.
Right.
Yeah, you need the space. Cool. You need turtles trying to climb over the piles of mantras. It's very hard for the little turtles' feet, you know. Okay, well, if I've covered all the questions for people, then why don't we take the last few minutes and we'll sit in meditation, whatever practice, you know, Zen or mindfulness or whatever you would like to do. Sensei Ken, do you have the bell handy?
You know, I actually don't. I've been putting things away, and it's not right here available. Sorry.
Well, you're fired.
I know, right?
I have one in the other room if you want me to go.
No, that's okay. I think we could all manage without a bell one time, right? So okay. So please get yourself situated, and we will we'll sit for about 15 minutes. offer up the merit to that so that all people can gain awakening. And if anyone has a question, I will entertain it before we close off here. Okay. Well, thank you all for tuning in. And sorry, someone had something?
Oh, no? Just thank you.
Oh, well, thank you. It was very nice. And I will be here next Sunday as well.
And if you're here on Tuesday, it's a different link, I think, to the Zoom meeting. So just make sure you go on Meetup and get the link, or Ken will email it to whoever's on the newsletter.
We'll use the, I think we'll use this new link, but yeah.
Okay.
And then actually I'm going to send an email out, because we thought we might have one more week of meeting outside. So we might meet outside on Thursday as our last one of the fall, and then meet virtually by Zoom on Tuesday for the teaching with David on the Anapanasati Sutra. So I'll send that out, and if anybody objects, then we'll take that into account.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you, everyone.
Okay.
Bye. And especially for all the people who helped set this up, so it worked.
Thanks, Steph.
Yes. Thank you, Steph.
Thanks. Bye.
Thank you.
That is the all the people.
That's all the people. Yeah. She's more than enough.
Thank you. Thank you, sir.
Okay, have a great Sunday,
everyone. Yeah.